From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, we welcome J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, Dan Ravid, Senior Washington Correspondent for I-24 News, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C.
Welcome, everyone. Usually, I would say at this point, here are the issues. Today, we will cover just one issue, gun violence and the growing specter of white nationalism and hate crime in the United States. We will discuss the most recent shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. We will review the response of the politicians and the public, and we will attempt to outline the basics of the path forward for a nation that is, by any estimation, at a crossroads. Gentlemen, JJ, welcome.
Thank you.
To the show.
Thank
for you, the first time. And give us some context for where we are, for those who may not have heard these details. A mass shooting occurred at a Walmart store in El Paso, Texas, in the United States on the morning of August 3rd, 2019. A lone gunman killed 22 people and injured 24 others. The 21-year-old man was arrested shortly after the shooting began and was charged with capital murder. Police believe that the suspect published a white nationalist anti-immigrant manifesto on social media before the attack. The post cites inspiration from the Christchurch, New Zealand mosque shootings and refers to the white genocide conspiracy theory. With 22 fatalities, it was the third deadliest mass shooting in Texas history and the seventh deadliest in modern U.S. history. The crime is being investigated as an act of domestic terrorism and a possible hate crime by the FBI. Just 13 hours after that incident, a mass shooting was carried out in Dayton, Ohio. 10 people were killed, including the perpetrator, and 10 others were injured. 14 of the injured were shot by the gunman, who was killed by police within 30 seconds of the first shots being fired. The suspect's home was searched and found to contain a so-called hit list. There were other so-called red flags about this particular shooter, but there is no confirmed motivation for this particular crime. We do know that he used a semi-automatic weapon based on the AR-15 assault rifle and armed with a 100-round drum magazine. Dan, we'll start with you. Your comments and all of this is just horrid and sickening. Are there any other details that I may have left out of that we know at this time about the two incidents?
Well, you were talking about two mass shootings on the weekend of August 3rd and 4th, but just a few days before that, July 29th in Gilmore, California, a man showed up at an outdoor festival and opened fire, sprayed bullets, killed four people, including a little boy, 6 years old, and again, the motive not clear. So what we have here is often when Americans get angry, they're able to get guns and bullets and take out their anger on other people. And in fact, there's a history of some people, it's almost always men, not women, by the way, doing this because they want what's called suicide by cop, that they're hoping to die that day. They want to go out with some blaze of glory or achieving some kind of significance and therefore killing people and then apparently hoping that police will kill them and that will end their miserable lives. But then you have that one incident in El Paso, Texas, that is different because the shooter there, almost for certain it was he, had put on an internet website what you'd have to call a manifesto, a long statement about who he hates, what concerned him, and among other things, he felt that Hispanics, people from Mexico and other parts of Latin America, were taking over America, especially the state of Texas. So he was going to take action against that. And just to put a little bit of American politics here, the Democrats especially are pointing out that the language of the hateful manifesto included a lot of phrases that President Donald Trump has been saying at his rallies about this country being under invasion by illegal immigrants. So one wonders if the shooter was inspired by the president, though the president during this past week said, "My rhetoric unites people." He, of course, denies having inspired anybody to violence.
JJ, more forensics on this particular event about the weapons that were used, about the fact that the perpetrator in the El Paso shooting drove 10 hours to commit this crime. Yeah. He was certainly targeting this particular community because of its demographic makeup.
That's right, 580 miles. And he was angry. He had a serious weapon with him. And he had a motive, as you laid out earlier. His inspiration was the Christchurch attack. Attacks earlier.
The attack on the mosque in New Zealand.
Right. So to step back a little bit further, the month of May, there was another mass shooting, Virginia Beach, not too far from where I grew up. And this is a trend. in the U.S. And here's the thing that makes all of these interesting and ties them all together. There are a lot of divisions in the U.S. at this point. There are foreign actors who recognize that there are these divisions, and they are trying to fan the flames of all of this on social media, on the internet. The Russians proved that back in 2016. Now other actors are jumping on the bandwagon. The FBI has told me 3 or 4 times this year alone that they see a growing preponderance of domestic violence in the U.S., domestic terrorism rather, as opposed to international terrorism in the U.S. using these massive destructive type weapons, and they are very concerned about the resources that they need, getting a plan together and actually being able to act on this. So when you look at what took place with this suspect in El Paso, he was the latest individual to bite on his hatred, his anger, and the opportunity to go someplace and to inflict some serious harm and to make a point, to get his point across and to actually put himself in this picture that so often exists these days and is growing significantly.
Clearly, these people are feeling a call to action at some point. And to back up with some numbers, your statement about the growth of this type of domestic terrorism. From 2009 to 2018, the far right has been responsible for 73% of domestic extremist-related fatalities, according to a 2019 study by the Anti-Defamation League. Dan?
Well, I was thinking about whether the attackers are typically activists whom we would know about for years, you know, someone who gets on a soapbox and gives a speech every weekend or stirs things up politically at their school. And typically, no.
That is a question. Who are these people and what do they want?
I mean, I understand they're men and they're loners and they're angry, but even the fellow in Texas who apparently murdered 22 people, he only posted his hate-filled so-called manifesto like 15 minutes before the crime. And his own family, as usual, this is typical, said, "We had no idea. We knew he had a gun, but we didn't know he was so angry."
You know, if you go back to some years ago, the Pulse nightclub shooting in Florida.
That was 49 people killed.
49. Yes.
So there was a situation where the perpetrator in that attack had an issue too, and suddenly popped up on the radar just before all this took place. Yeah. And essentially was engaging in the same process. And what I learned from that, from talking to the sources that I talked to in Homeland and law enforcement security, is that a lot of these people, including these, I would imagine, in these last 3 attacks in the last week or so, 2 weeks, were all picking and choosing from ideologies and tactics to help them execute what it was that they wanted to do. And there's this great pool of domestic terrorist information out there. A lot of it was born out of the international terrorism activity and ideology that now a lot of these people who are not identified with any group or with any cause or not activists, as you say, but are people that are just living what we think are quiet lives, but they're quietly seething.
Let's just get to, I would say, a topic that is serving as one of those points of division that you talked about earlier. And the fact that I think intuitively and empirically, we can say that white supremacy, this white nationalism, domestic terror is real and it is on the rise. There have been, in response to these 2 shootings in particular, there have been statements by Democratic presidential candidates very implicitly that the president has contributed to this, that his rhetoric has inflamed people who are prone to this type of violence. And they have even gone so far as to call the president himself a white supremacist. Dan, is this a fair track to go down for the president or any politician to lay the blame at the foot of a president and say that your words create these actions?
Well, here on Issues in the News, we try to take a step back, and so it makes me wonder, is it doing any good? If what we want to do is prevent mass murder incidents, to have politicians blaming each other may not add to the chance of some resolution, right? This is the month of August in which Congress is not in session, a long recess. They're coming back in early September. There's the hope among many people that somehow Democrats and Republicans could work together for something that has to do with perhaps gun control, though in general the Republican Party is opposed to that, believing that all Americans have the right to bear arms, to own a gun. And that's protected by
the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And let me say, not just own a gun, apparently to own any gun.
to own guns.
To own any gun.
Well, and Republicans in general and other gun rights supporters think that those rights shouldn't be infringed at all, because if you limit it even a little, they believe, then that is a slope toward eliminating all guns and confiscating them. And that, they say, would be un-American. So I'm saying, when you are pointing the finger of blame and calling Donald Trump names or vice versa, he usually responds by, I'm the least racist person in the world, so they're racist by saying I'm racist. It becomes almost childish. It doesn't help, but it's going to happen. And why? Because the presidential campaign for November of next year is already underway. And so there are going to be fingers of blame, but I don't think it's going to accelerate the chances of Congress or anybody reducing gun violence.
Okay, so Dan has just voiced reasonable and rational. But when we talk about what is actually existing here, because we have clearly a lot of emotion that's wrapped up, yes, into this situation, when you have people being murdered by the dozen, and you do have a president who has seemed to wrap his arms around this fringe element of society that previously had no voice at the highest levels of government and seemingly does now. This is not anyone's imagination who believes that it is true. They clearly believe and have evidence that this is so.
Well, when you look at what the president said, he said what he said. There's no way to take it back. I mean, we can massage it. We can do whatever we want to do with it.
And he can make a speech from the teleprompter, as he did in the White House, and say that he's against hate in all forms and that sort of thing. So he says those words, but there's the other words as well.
You're saying the other words say at his political rallies when he warns about invaders coming.
Well, this is the point that I'm making. When you take all of those words together, there are so many things for anybody to pick and choose what they want him to have said, what they heard. And oftentimes it's different. And there is no question that some of the things that the president has engaged in has been viewed by many in this white supremacist or white nationalist community as a call to action for them or support for them. Here's the thing. We're in a studio right now. There are people on the other side of the window. We can't hear what they're saying. So imagine that we're in this place where people, the politicians, are yelling at each other and pointing fingers and this, that, and the other. The people on the other side of that glass are the national security and the law enforcement professionals that are jumping up and down and saying, hey, this is going to get worse. This is going to happen. This is a problem. Stop yakking at each other and stop doing this childish finger-pointing thing and give us the money, give us the plan, give us the people that we need to engage with it so we can stop it. This is the problem that a lot of the national security people are seeing, the Homeland Security people are seeing, is this train that people are on that are just pointing and yelling and careening forward, and more mass shootings are happening. And, you know, there's this whole idea about, okay, let's kick the can down the road or push the train a little bit further down the road. Maybe we'll deal with it and it'll get better, but it's not. And what's happened is the president's words. What's happened is the words from other politicians back to him have just inflamed this even more, and more people are upset, and more of them are looking for ways to get active.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the president and his role in what comes next after this break, when we'll be back with more of Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. Dan Levine, Senior Washington Correspondent for I-24 News. And our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Dan, when we talk about what can be done about this, there's two tracks I want to take here. First, the people that are going to be involved in whatever happens, that's the Congress of the United States, the president himself. We can talk about individuals within the legislative branch, like Senate Leader Mitch McConnell. Really, the situation is, when you have a country that has as many guns in the U.S., isn't the fact that the number of guns is really at the crux of the problem here?
Well, when you travel around the world, people ask Americans all the time. And I'll bet here at the Voice of America, there are a lot of emails and questions that come up from the world, like, why do you have so many killings? Why do you have so many guns? So again, at the basis, the right to own a gun or guns or whatever, and people argue about the exact wording of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. So it dates back to, you know, before the year 1800. These important amendments are basic rights in this country. It's part of America, the right to own a gun. The whole world is puzzled at it, but it indeed has grown into the fact that we Americans have more guns per person, per capita, than any other nation. And so I think that other countries also have all kind of outlandish, extreme political arguments, people with extreme views. The internet is everywhere. These right-wing websites and, frankly, extreme left-wing and Islamist and anti-Islamist and all sorts of websites exist everywhere around the world. But our country stands out as a country that has so many more guns in private hands, easy to buy, sometimes legally, sometimes not. There are just so many guns. You can't reverse that. So I imagine that both Congress and the president and also the security establishment of this country, the FBI and police agencies, they just have to live with that reality and think about how to reduce gun violence and killings within the reality that America has all the guns. I know there's a lot of call, especially from liberals and Democrats, for gun control. And if anything, at least it would show that Congress really cares and does something when it comes back from its recess next month. But will that really reduce the number of killings? I kind of doubt it. It could send a message, but I don't know that it would reduce the killings.
The morning after the El Paso shooting, I heard the lieutenant governor, the second ranking official in the state of Texas, go on television, on conservative talk television, and say that the problems were, in order, video games, mental health, lack of prayer, and poor diet. Anything except guns. It was fascinating to me.
And the president's speech, which was a serious one that he simply read off the teleprompter, did not mention any problem that there are too many guns. And he said, we need a cultural change. He mentioned the violent video game.
Bringing me to my point, where is the legislation for video games? Where is the legislation for mental health for all? If this are the problems, where are the solutions?
But look, gentlemen, we all know the real problem is not the video games. It's not the diet. It's not anything else except the fact that there is a gigantic availability of guns, all types of guns, and America does have a racial problem, a hate problem. And this goes back centuries. And in order to get to where, in my opinion, Americans say we want to get to, it's going to have to be addressed. And this is the thing that nobody has been able to, or maybe not been willing to do. And I may sound radical.
But JJ, you also mixed in a social issue, that there's racism and a race problem with the availability of guns. Yeah. So I want to know, because I know you are known as a security expert in the American media.
But also,
so are you also living with the availability of guns that can't
so also much? I'm an African American who grew up in the South, who also understands how all this mixes together, and also have seen situations where things have exploded that could have been dealt with differently, and in the process there are guns available. So what I'm saying very simply is all of the things that have been mentioned, all the political, all the cultural, and, you know, all of the security issues have to be dealt with, and they need to be dealt with appropriately and strongly. But we have to have a conversation about race in America.
And I think we're at that point now where we're having that conversation.
It.
Yes, you're right. We're past that point. It's come to a different tone, and you have to say it's come to a different tone because of the president of the United States and the way that he has positioned race and religion in his political talks. His one main issue, undeniably, is immigration. It's the first thing he talked about when he started his campaign in 2015.
And then he proudly says, I'm a nationalist. He knows that white nationalist would be a terrible, terrible term.
Again.
But at a rally, he repeated, yeah, I'm a nationalist. People don't like the word. I'm a nationalist, meaning he's a pure American. And he doesn't want to discuss what is that purity. Is it only white people? Is it only Christians? He's just not saying, but so, it gives a feeling and gives comfort to racists.
Everybody around the world knows exactly what those terms mean. And if you look at some of the information that was gathered from the Russian trolls and the Russian activities during the 2016 election run-up and campaign, there was this whole target set of folks in the Black Lives Matter movement. There were steps that were taken by this organization, the Trolls, and the Russian-supported online activists that were designed to push buttons. And they were all racially tinged. The question about nationalism is something that comes directly from this Russian playbook. I'm not saying that the president, you know, is delivering Russian dog whistles or any other kind of dog whistles. I think he's saying what he truly thinks. But people, the interpretation of what he says is the key. And the Russians knew back then, and others know now, that when you mention that word nationalism to certain audiences, to certain demographics in this country, it's not going to come out like nationalism, it's going to come out like racism.
So it's going to stir up trouble and divisions, and that's what our foreign foes would like to see.
Exactly, and that's what they're doing. So I'm not sure where the president is going with this.
I think he wants to be the president who finally did something about this. That's his general nature, and that's what during
the past.
What
gives you that idea?
Again, he loves to be a winner. I don't think he wants to reduce the number of guns in this country, and he seems to be reaching out in various directions. I don't think people with mental illness should be able to get guns, so therefore there should be greater background checks, and then he sort of drops that when the so-called gun lobby is in touch with him. No, again, I think he wants to be the guy who during election year can say, I did something. And on the immigration issue, again, just fair reporting to our audience around the world. Once this past week, he made a point of adding, I do want immigration. If it's illegal immigration, we have so many companies moving to the U.S. They need a lot of workers. I just want people to come in legally. But of course, skeptics about Trump say, nah, he didn't really mean
that. Well, again, as you said, clearly you'd like those people to be from Ireland and Norway. But you know, that's you know, another issue. Let's talk about the president as uniter or divider and as his role as consoler-in-chief, because this is a role that's been accepted by some quite naturally because of their demeanor, and some eventually because events forced it upon them. But the role of uniter and consoler in times of tragedy of the United States is something that we've come to expect from presidents. And it seems as though that isn't either something that President Trump is able to do or willing to do. I now ask both of the guests, do you think that it is something that is beyond capability or just actually a political expediency for him not to be that person?
Wasn't it interesting? He did know he should make the trip. So the president and his wife, Melania Trump, did go to both Dayton, Ohio and El Paso, Texas this past Thursday. And so they visited the hospitals. They wanted to see the wounded. They wanted to see first responders and medical staffs. They got some applause there. And then he stirred up more political controversy by saying very negative things about various Democrats who he felt had blasted him. Yes, even on that day that he's trying to be consoler in chief.
Listen, you know, everybody has redeeming qualities, regardless of how terrible we are as human beings or not. Not saying that the president is a terrible human being, but he's done things that have upset people. I mean, he's done things that made people on his own team quit in disgust. But he's also done what you said he did the other day. He went to El Paso and Dayton. Was it the right thing to do? You know, I can't answer that. It's not my place to answer it. Should he focus more on being the consoler in chief in times like this as opposed to the political part? I would say so. But this is, at the end of the day, a very difficult time that we're in. And from my perspective, looking at things from a security point of view, all of this comes back to, at the end of the day, what's the person, the guy or the woman that's watching all of what's unfolding, happening now, who has an issue, who also has access to a gun? What are they going to do with what they see him do and say now? How are they going to internalize that? And when they, because there's going to be another, let's be clear about it. So when they get ready to make their move or to decide what they're going to do, how is what he did and what he's doing now going to play in their minds? And that's the thing at the end of the day that I think is most important about what he says and what he does right now.
Dan, that could be the last word on the president.
Yeah, I can see the question there is whether he actually is reducing gun violence by visiting hospitals, by saying anything, or will he try to come up with action with his party, the Republicans? They are the majority in the Senate. The House, controlled by Democrats, did pass some additional background checks and, if you will, some gun control. And the Republicans who control the Senate did not want to proceed with that. Maybe next month will make a difference. Again, I'm doubtful it's going to reduce the number of mass murders in this country, but at least Congress would be saying we want to do something.
I'm going to finish with just a few quick words. In preparing to do this show, I did some research on how much it costs to buy the military-grade weapons and ammunition that was used in the attacks in El Paso and Dayton. I found out that you can arm yourself like a NATO soldier for about $500. There are more guns than people in the United States, as you said, Dan. And many of those guns are capable of taking a dozen souls in just a few seconds. More Americans were killed in those two incidents this past weekend that we have discussed than American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2019 combined. These are facts. It's also a fact that the United States does have a problem with hate, as you said, JJ, which in my mind is a problem with fear. Fear of loss, fear of the other. And when fear ferments into hate, and the most lethal weapons on the planet are readily available as a means of expression, it is not surprising that mayhem is the result. Hatred and violence in the culture are more than issues in the news. They are fundamental flaws that must be addressed with open minds and open hearts if the United States is to be a country with liberty and justice for all. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and Dan Revive, Senior Washington Correspondent for I-24 News. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Wagner Roberts, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.